From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Islamic State insurgents more than terrorists. Israel-Gaza fighting intensifying. Uncertain future awaits Somali refugees, plus West Africa's Ebola outbreak. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is warning that the Islamic State is more than a typical terrorist group and is an imminent threat to the United States. We get more now from VOA correspondent Meredith Buell.
Speaking to reporters at the Pentagon, Secretary Hagel says U.S. airstrikes have helped stall the momentum of Islamic State militants in Iraq and have enabled Iraqi and Kurdish forces to regain their footing. However, he expects the insurgents to regroup and stage a new offensive.
They're beyond just a terrorist group. They marry ideology, a sophistication of strategic and tactical military prowess. They are tremendously well-funded. Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen.
Hagel described Islamic State fighters as barbaric, saying they present a serious threat to the United States and other countries.
They have no standard of decency, of responsible human behavior, and I think the record's pretty clear on that. So, yes, they are an imminent threat to every interest we have, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else.
General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the Islamic State could pose a threat to Western countries through the return home of U.S. or European nationals who have fought for the militant group in Syria or Iraq.
ISIS will only truly be defeated when it's rejected by the 20 million disenfranchised Sunni that happen to reside between Damascus and Baghdad.
Their comments came days after Islamic State militants released a video showing the beheading of American journalist James Foley. Foley was a reporter for Global Post when he was captured in Syria in 2012. His news outlet says the kidnappers demanded $132 million in exchange for his release. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf says it has long been American policy not to pay ransom in instances where U.S. citizens are being held captive in combat zones.
The United States government believes very strongly that paying ransom to terrorists gives them a tool in the form of financing that helps them propagate what they're doing. And so we believe very strongly that we don't do that.
U.S. commandos did attempt to rescue Foley and other Americans in Syria. However, the mission failed because the hostages were not at the location where they were believed to have been held. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
United States has launched what it describes as one of the biggest aid operations in 30 years at the United Nations, and in northern Iraq it will be, as hundreds of thousands of refugees flee the Islamic State insurgents. As Kurdish and Iraqi forces battle the extremists, the fighting has forced more people to flee their homes. Kurdish authorities say the international community must act now to avert a humanitarian catastrophe. Henry Ridgewell is in London with our report.
Sunburned and dehydrated from their trek across the desert, thousands of refugees continue to arrive at camps in Iraqi Kurdistan, alongside ethnic minorities like Yazidis and Christians fleeing the Islamic State militants. There are Sunni and Shia Muslims escaping the violence. In the space of just a few weeks, an estimated 1.2 million Iraqis have been forced to flee their homes. The United Nations began an operation Wednesday to supply basic needs to about 500,000 of the refugees. Marcio Babile is the UN's humanitarian coordinator for Iraq.
This is probably one of the largest supply-driven operations of the United Nations over the last 30 years because of the intensity of displacement and because of the time-bound of this displacement. Extraordinary high numbers of people, women, children, families displaced in a very short time bound, which is probably less than 1 week.
Aid has been flown in from Jordan and the United Arab Emirates. More will arrive by road from Turkey and by sea from Dubai and Iran. The Bajet Kandela camp was built as a transit point on the border for Syrians fleeing their civil war. Now it is home to more than 11,000 Iraqis. UN field officer Bazad Amin says the camp has doubled in size in the last 2 weeks.
This is a very urgent need for the families. So we are trying to manage better for the basic facilities, water delivery, latrines installation, and so on.
Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region has had its budget cut by the central government in Baghdad in a dispute over oil. The Kurdistan Regional Government's representative in London, Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman, says the KRG cannot cope with the refugee influx alone.
These are people who've seen murder, rape, genocide. They're traumatized. They have nothing, literally nothing, except the clothes on their back. They have nothing to cook with. They have no toilet facilities. They don't have access to clean water. We need a serious humanitarian push from the international community. Otherwise, there will be an outbreak of disease, and things will get even worse now in Kurdistan.
Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi visited a camp near Erbil Wednesday. He voiced the hope of the international community that the new Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi can offer a solution to the growing humanitarian crisis. Mr. Renzi said he hopes that Mr. Haider al-Abadi is able to rapidly create a cabinet that can meet expectations, not just the expectations of Iraqi Kurdistan President Masoud Barzani of the Kurdish government, but the expectations of the whole Iraqi population, and he added, the expectations of the whole world. Authorities in northern Iraq say the world must help it deal with twin crises, a well-armed and brutal terrorist group in the Islamic State and the humanitarian crisis it has created. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Also in the news, air bombardments and rocket fire between Israel and Gaza intensified on Thursday after Israeli airstrikes killed three senior Hamas commanders overnight. VOA's Scott Bobb is in Jerusalem with the story.
The Israeli military said its forces pounded rocket installations in the Gaza Strip as dozens of rockets landed in southern Israel. Israel said more than 200 rockets had been fired at Israel, and its forces had targeted more than 100 rocket installations in Gaza since a temporary ceasefire collapsed on Monday. The Hamas group that controls Gaza announced that three senior Hamas military commanders had been killed in overnight airstrikes. Israeli defense forces confirmed the deaths. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said following a meeting of his security ministers that the operation against Gaza would continue. He said only the guarantee of the calm and safety of Israeli citizens will bring an end to this operation, and therefore we are talking about a long and continuing campaign. He added that Hamas leaders were not only legitimate targets, but targets of high priority. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri said the threat reflected the extent of Israel's violence and lack of seriousness in achieving a ceasefire. He said these threats will not frighten Hamas leaders. On the contrary, we will continue to protect and defend our people in facing Israeli crimes. Hamas's military wing threatened to launch attacks against Israel's main airport near Tel Aviv. The airport Thursday appeared to be operating normally. Each side accuses the other of breaking the temporary ceasefire Monday after 10 days of negotiations and calm. Some progress had been reported in the talks on a permanent truce brokered by Egypt, but the two sides remained far apart on their principal demands. Hamas wants Israel to end the 7-year-old blockade of Gaza, while Israel wants all militant groups in Gaza to disarm. During the 6 weeks of violence, more than 2,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of them civilians, according to Palestinian authorities. On the Israeli side, 64 soldiers and 3 civilians have been killed. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Outgoing UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay has scolded the UN Security Council for its lack of action on some of the world's most serious crises. We get more now from VOA's Margaret Bashir at the UN in New York.
Former South African jurist Navi Pillay will wrap up a 6-year tenure as the top UN human rights official at the end of this month. Known for her outspokenness on topics ranging from the conflict in Syria to gay rights, in her final briefing, Pillay spoke of crises around the world, from the Middle East to Africa to the Ukraine.
None of these crises erupted without warning. They built up over years and sometimes decades of human rights grievances, deficient or corrupt governance, and judicial institutions. discrimination and exclusion, inequities in development, exploitation and denial of economic and social rights, and repression of civil society and public freedoms.
She said early detection mechanisms repeatedly warned of these potential crises.
So, although the specifics of each crisis could not necessarily be predicted, many of the human rights violations that were at their core were known. They could have been addressed.
On the more than 3-year war in Syria, she warned the conflict is spreading outward and its eventual limits cannot be predicted. Palais said such crises highlight the full cost of the international community's failure to prevent conflict. She said it is first the state's duty to protect its citizens, but when it fails, the UN Security Council must act.
But when governments are unwilling or unable to protect their people, it is the responsibility of the international community and singularly this council to intervene and to deploy the range of good offices, support, inducements, and coercion at its disposal to defuse the triggers of conflict.
In an apparent reference to the lack of consensus among council members on issues such as Syria, she said short-term geopolitical concerns and narrowly defined national interests have repeatedly taken priority over ending human suffering.
I firmly believe that greater responsiveness by this council would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
During Thursday's meeting, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon paid tribute to Commissioner Pillay, saying she has been an outstanding United Nations leader who tells it like she sees it. He said people who face discrimination and rights abuses know she is their advocate and she will continue to be a key voice for human rights. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Intense calm reported Thursday in the West Point area of Liberia's capital, Monrovia, a day after riot police clashed with residents who tried to break a quarantine placed on the area in an attempt to contain the spread of Ebola. At least 4 people were injured Wednesday when police fired bullets and tear gas to disperse the protesters who were upset by the sudden blockade of roads in and out of their neighborhood. A nationwide curfew is also in place in an effort to halt the spread of the virus. Liberia has been hit especially hard by the outbreak, the World Health Organization saying 90% of new Ebola deaths are reported to have occurred there. The WHO says just under 2,500 people have been infected by Ebola, with more than 1,350 dying from it. 2 American aid workers who were infected with Ebola have been discharged from an Atlanta hospital here in the U.S. 33-year-old Dr. Kent Brantley and 59-year-old Nancy Wrightbull were infected while working at a missionary clinic in the West African nation of Liberia. Wrightbull is with the medical missionary group SIM International, which operates the Monrovia Clinic. Dr. Brantley is with the medical relief group Samaritan's Purse. He spoke Thursday just before leaving Emory University Hospital in Atlanta.
Thank you to the Samaritan's Purse and SIM Liberia community. You cared for me and ministered to me during the most difficult experience of my life. Please do not stop praying for the people of Liberia and West Africa and for a quick end to this Ebola epidemic.
Dr. Brantley said Nancy Wrightbull were given the experimental drug ZMapp and flown from Liberia back to the United States for their treatment. Wrightbull left the hospital's isolation unit 2 days before Dr. Brantley, so he spoke on her behalf Thursday.
My dear friend Nancy Wrightbull, upon her release from the hospital, wanted me to share her gratitude for all of the prayers on her behalf. As she walked out of her isolation room, all she could say was, "To God be the glory."
Head of Emory University's Infectious Disease Unit, Dr. Bruce Ribner, said they released the patients following standard World Health Organization and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines.
The standard World Health Organization and CDC guidelines that have been used in the third world have been absence of virus in the blood and patient symptomatically improved for at least 2 to 3 days.
Calling Ebola a fairly devastating disease, Ribner said most patients, if they have not had any substantial organ damage, will make a complete recovery. The United Nations Refugee Agency has called for East African countries who are hosting Somali refugees to make voluntary reparations possible and sustainable. Mohamed Youssef has more from the VOA East Africa Bureau.
Earlier this month, some UNHCR workers and Somali refugee leaders in the Dadaab camp traveled to the port city of Kismayu to assess the security and socio-economic situation of the city as part of the repatriation process. UNHCR in Kenya spokesman Emmanuel Nyabera says security is a major challenge in south and central Somalia, and the group's visit helps the refugees make decisions knowing what awaits them if they decide to go back.
They noticed that some areas needed a lot of support and concern, like the medical facilities were not as good as needed. Education system was a little bit a challenge because the curriculum was not very well defined. These are some of the things that they came and shared with refugees in the camps, and this will enable refugees to make informed decisions.
For more than two decades, Somalia has witnessed a cycle of violence that has forced about 2 million people to flee and displaced hundreds of thousands inside the country. Relative peace is returning to some parts of the country after African Union troops and Somali government forces pushed back Al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab. Despite the security challenges, Nyabera says the UN agency is ready to support those refugees willing to go back home.
We have to emphasize that so far we are not promoting repatriation as such, because most of the areas where Somalis want to go to, the southern central part of Somalia, are not safe enough. But then we are able to start preparations to see how many people want to go. We have opened information desks in the camps, all the five camps in Dadaab, where we are addressing some of the concerns of the Somali refugees.
Somali government representatives have withdrawn several times from negotiations on repatriation between Kenya and the UNHCR, citing human rights abuses against Somali refugees living in urban centres. In April, Kenyan security forces carried out a major security crackdown they say was intended to flush out Al-Shabaab members and sympathisers. More than 5,000 Somalis were arrested. Last month, humanitarian agencies warned of a possible famine like one 3 years ago that killed a quarter of a million Somalis. Aid workers fear a food shortage would force thousands of Somalis back to camps. Mohamed Youssef for VOA News, Nairobi.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
The governor of the U.S. state of Missouri on Thursday ordered the withdrawal of the National Guard from a town rocked by nearly 2 weeks of protest following the August 9th shooting death of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white policeman. The national troops arrived in Ferguson on Monday to support police after violent clashes with protesters. More than 150 people have been arrested in Ferguson since protests began, mainly for failing to disperse at the request of the police. Local, state, and federal investigations are underway into the shooting that took place there on August the 9th. A new report says global spending for capital projects and infrastructure will top $9 trillion by the year 2025. That's up from $4 trillion in 2012. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The spending projections are contained in a new report from PwC, with assistance from Oxford Economics. The report analyzes infrastructure spending in 49 of the world's largest economies. They account for 90% of the global economic output. The Outlook to 2025 report focuses on five sectors: extraction industries, utilities, transport, manufacturing, and social, which includes city infrastructure. The findings say emerging markets mostly China and other Asian countries, will see much faster growth in infrastructure spending. One reason is because the region did not have the burden of recovering from a financial crisis. Another is big demand in China. Europe has recovered slowly from the economic crisis, which has constrained infrastructure spending. And spending in North America is a distant second to Asia. PwC's main role for its clients centers on audit and assurance, tax and consulting services. Jonathan Kaywood is the head of the firm's capital projects and infrastructure for Africa.
Africa's share of the global pie is 2%, but it's certainly growing quite significantly, and I think also we're seeing a significant uptick in spending across the region.
He lists the continent's leaders in infrastructure spending.
South Africa specifically has been dominant over the last few decades, but we see Nigeria catching up very quickly and probably in the next 2 to 3 years will overtake South Africa. And then the Eastern Corridor, Kenya is a gateway into Tanzania, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the resource-rich countries around there is also experiencing significant growth.
Nigeria's spending is forcast to grow from $23 billion in 2013 to $77 billion in 2025. Overall infrastructure spending in sub-Saharan Africa is forcast to grow by 10% a year over the next 10 years. If the forecast holds true, the amount would be more than $180 billion. Kaywood says where that money is spent could be affected by climate change.
Certainly when one looks at fragile power, transport and water and city infrastructure, often Africa is more exposed. So particularly along the east coast, a country like Mozambique is exposed to regular flooding, and with that comes disease and power outages and transportation going down. And I think when one looks at hydropower, there are big questions around the key river basins in Africa and whether the water level and volumes are going to be sustainable.
That sustainability could be hindered by more frequent droughts and floods, some of the effects of climate change. Infrastructure spending could also be affected by rapid urbanization. The PwC report projects the biggest shifts in urbanized populations will be in China, India, Ghana, Nigeria, and the Philippines. Kaywood says urbanization and demographic shifts will have implications for Africa's cities.
Most of them are growing very rapidly, often in a fairly unstructured way. Most of them are pretty gridlocked and oversubscribed in terms of basic services, whether it be housing, transport, ICT, water, power.
The report says demographic shifts will leave a lasting fundamental imprint on infrastructure development for decades to come. Africa will probably need some outside help in infrastructure development. China's infrastructure spending includes major investments in Africa. Kaywood describes it as formidable.
It by far dwarfs any other source of investment, and many of the projects in Africa are being delivered by Chinese funders and construction firms, often led by their state-owned entities.
Kaywood says driving most of the investment in Africa will be resource and consumer market potential, along with trade and economic and political reforms. He adds it's crucial for policymakers, citizens, and businesses to understand the factors that unlock infrastructure and development, and then act responsibly and strategically. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
One of the largest U.S. banks, Bank of America, is paying a record fine of nearly $17 billion because of bad housing loans it sold to investors, helping trigger the world recession. It is the biggest settlement ever between the U.S. government and a private corporation. The fine imposed on Bank of America is about equal to its total profit for the last 3 years. And now it's time to say goodbye to you. Thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America and International Edition. You know you can find a podcast of this broadcast plus others by going to voanews.com, looking under the Programs tab for International Edition. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On August 22, 1864, Swiss businessman Henri Dunant and the Geneva Society for Public Welfare brought together representatives from 16 European nations to adopt the first Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention not only mandated the care of the sick and wounded in times of war, but established the neutrality of all medical personnel. The Geneva Society for Public Welfare would later become the International Red Cross, and in honor of Dunant's nationality, a Red Cross on a white background, the Swiss flag in reverse, was chosen as its symbol. In 1901, Dunant received another honor, a share in the first Nobel Prize for Peace. In 1906, the Victor Talking Machine Company of Camden, New Jersey, began marketing the Victor Victrola, or phonograph. The hand-cranked unit sold for $200. In 1911, officials at the Louvre in Paris discovered the theft of Leonardo da Vinci's painting Mona Lisa the day before. 2 years later, in Florence, the masterpiece was recovered when the thief tried to sell it to an art dealer. And on this day in 1981, the British-American rock group Foreigner had the top album on the U.S. pop charts. Simply titled Four, the group's fourth album featured three hits, including this. With hits like Waiting for a Girl Like You, Foreigner was a major musical force in the 1980s, selling more than 50 million records worldwide. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the sentences handed down to four more Russian protesters who participated in the Bolotnaya Square demonstrations in Moscow in May 2012. During those demonstrations, thousands of Russians took to the streets protesting disputed election results and Vladimir Putin's return to the presidency of Russia. According to Amnesty International, the demonstrations were mostly peaceful, but were violently dispersed by the police, who arrested hundreds of protesters. Since then, more than a dozen Bolotnaya demonstrators have been tried and given prison sentences. In its most recent human rights report on Russia, the U.S. State Department notes that human rights groups believe that the arrest, detention, and punishment of such a diverse group of individuals were meant to deter the population from engaging in public protests. In addition, after the Bolotnaya protests, the Russian government began a crackdown on dissent, which includes, the State Department said, selectively employing a law on foreign agents, the law against extremism, and other means to harass, pressure, discredit, and/or prosecute individuals and entities that voiced criticism of the government, including non-governmental organizations, independent media outlets, and the political opposition. At a press briefing on August 18th, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf expressed deep concern over the latest sentences of Bolotnaya protesters. Alexander Margolin and Alexei Gaskarov were sentenced to 3.5 years in prison, Ilya Gushchin to 2.5 years. Yelena Katarova received a suspended sentence, all on charges of taking part in mass protests and rioting. Ms. Harf noted that the verdicts follow those of two other individuals last month who were accused of organizing the protests. These politically-minded trials have been marked by a lack of due process, and arrests of other participants continue more than 2 years after the demonstration, said spokesperson Harf. The Russian people deserve a government that values the contributions of all its citizens, that cultivates an open marketplace of ideas, and that respects universal rights and fundamental freedoms.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.